The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello friends, I'm your host, Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast.
Neil, how are you, sir?
I'm good. Not too bad. Glad to be back in the UK.
Yes. We were just saying, weren't we? You're filming your new production, The Lair.
Yeah.
Just from the little bit that I read, did I get it right? A female fighter pilot shot down in Afghanistan.
Yes, there's a female RAF pilot shot down in Afghanistan. Hooked up with some US soldiers out there, and there's also some SAS guys who are in the neighborhood, and end up having to do battle with this former Russian science experiment that's come back to life. It's very much in the kind of the school, like it's like a sort of sister film to Dog Soldiers, I suppose, or a brother film. Soldiers and Monsters. I'm just having a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, I bet. I wanted to ask you, first off, should we just say a massive thank you to Mark Ryan, who's been...
Absolutely. I was going to say, like, it's brilliant of Mark to put us in touch. Mark is a very, very good friend. I was lucky enough to work with him on first on Black Sails, having been a fan of his for years and years, from Who Dares Wins to Robin of Sherwood and such like, to get to work with him on Black Sails. And then we worked together again a couple of years back on The Reckoning as well.
Yes, my son just refers to Mark as Bumblebee.
I guess that's how the new generation know him. But for us, he'll always be Nazir.
Yes, of course. And how is it for the new generation then, that do many of them pick up on Dog Soldiers?
Dog Soldiers just seems to be like sort of an eternally kind of loved movie. I mean, I don't necessarily know that many of the new generation, but it's constantly being asked about and constantly being, the big question being is like, is there going to be a Dog Soldiers, even 20 years later, is there going to be a Dog Soldiers sequel? So there seems, you know, the interest and love for the film and affection for the movie just seems to keep on going, which is lovely, you know, to have created something that people like so much, you know?
Yes, exactly. To have a film that becomes a cult classic just must be a writer and director's dream.
Well, it is. You don't plan for that. I just planned. I kind of threw everything in with the kitchen sink when I was making it. It was my first feature and had a whole bunch of ideas and threw all sorts of things in there, and a lot of them stuck. And I always just imagined it as being like sort of, I wanted it to be like the ultimate post-pub movie that, you know, you and your mates come back from the pub, haven't had a few, sit down and watch it, and it just like, it hits all the marks for that. And I guess that still stands, you know, as long as people are still going to pubs and, you know, on Friday night or whatever, and you and your mates want to sit down and watch a movie, that's the perfect movie for it.
Yes. The classic line in the whole film is Sean Pertwee, who plays Wet Wells, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he goes to grab a weapon and it's a stick. And he says to the werewolf, fetch. That's, I reckon that touched the funny bone of any squaddy watching.
I think so. Well, the thing is, there was quite a lot of improvised stuff in it. And I think, you know, that was one of the lines that, like, Sean said, you know, what if I throw it away? So say fetch. I was just like, I love it. That's brilliant. Let's do it. There's a lot of that going on because, like, Sean was so into his character and loved that character and got into the world of being a squaddie and just so well, you know. So they all did. I mean, by the end of the shoot, I think they all would have like fought and died for each other. They were so tight, you know.
Yes, I bet. Sean did another really great film a few years ago. You probably might remember the name of it, but it was set in Cornwall.
Blue Juice.
Blue Juice, that was right. I'll be honest, it was so long ago I watched it, I can't quite remember the plot, but I just remember it being...
Well, it's the Cornwall equivalent of Point Break or something. It's the ultimate Cornwall surfing movie, of which it comes from a genre of one.
Yes, and there's quite a lot of humour in it as well.
It's great. It was because of films like that that I knew I wanted to work with Sean and Dog Soldiers. Was like, I just thought he had such charisma, you know.
Yes, yes, and he's a Cornish boy, isn't he?
I think he is originally. Yeah,
I'm just going on the accent alone. It's funny. I've spent quite a lot of time in Cornwall this summer, and the Cornish do have a certain look to them. Not just, I mean, there is a big sort of surfer look thing going on down there, but Sean reminds me so much of one of the guys I was in the Marines with. It's just, it's almost a bit surreal.
Well, he's got a great face. It's kind of, it's very lived in, it's very weathered, it's very full of character.
Yes. So when you brought the SAS bit into the forest there, which is the heart or the Highlands, the woods in Scotland.
Yeah.
Which was filmed in Luxembourg, right?
Yeah, we did do a couple of days filming in Scotland just for the bigger shots and just to help establish it. Because Luxembourg was okay for forests and things like that, but it doesn't really look like Scotland aside from that.
Is that a difficult thing to get over, or is it sort of in... bear in mind, most people have probably never been to a Scottish forest, so
it's full of like pine forests and stuff like that, which Scotland also has a lot of. But when it comes to mountains, things like that, there's nothing like that in Luxembourg. So anything that had mountains in it, whatever, was Scotland. All the aerial stuff was Scotland. But yeah, so many of my films are like that you shoot a few days like somewhere really exotic, and then the rest is done somewhere, you know, pretty close to home. I mean, Centurion's a good example because we shot a week in Scotland, but all the rest was shot in Surrey, just outside London. But you'd never know that to watch the movie.
That's another one of the all-time classic film, Centurion. That was a Roman team of Romans trapped behind enemy lines. Yeah.
A lot of the movies that I've done have come from very drunken conversations in pubs. Dog Soldiers kind of originated around a table in a pub one day, I think. And Centurion was the same, was that a friend of mine told me about this the legend of the Ninth Legion, about this legion of Roman soldiers that marched into the misty Scottish mountains and vanished without a trace. And that just immediately like piqued my interest. I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. But also like, because where I grew up in Newcastle, right next to Hadrian's Wall, Romans, the Roman history is kind of a big part of my growing up. So this notion of like a legion of Romans marching through the wall and up into Scotland and then never coming back was like, okay, this is really fascinating, even if it's not entirely true, because like the myth's been disproved since then. But it's that old saying, was that when the legend becomes truth, print the legend. The myth was way more interesting than the truth, so I went with that. Yeah.
So going back in history then, did I get this right? Did the Romans met their sort of nemesis with taking on the tribes of Scotland and got their arse a bit kicked?
They did. They couldn't defeat the Picts in Scotland. I mean, that's why they built Hadrian's Wall, which is a pretty excessive thing to do. So it kind of makes you think that whatever was up there was pretty terrifying to them, that they built this enormous wall right across the country to prevent them invading. It's like, wow, they were really scared. So that makes the Picts sound pretty terrifying.
Yes, plus I'm thinking from a military point of view, you've got these boys from the Mediterranean in their skirts.
Exactly.
And then they're suddenly in the Scottish climate.
Yeah, and of course they picked, like, they fought battles mostly like naked, which is like, that must be pretty hardcore in the Highlands of Scotland in January as well.
Yes. Yeah, going back to the SAS thing, I wondered if that was like a plot mechanism, because obviously when the boys go on exercise, well, when the military goes on exercise, you're not carrying ammunition, are you? Not real proper ammunition.
No. I had to take a few liberties with the film to a point, but it was the idea that I don't even think he's specified as being SAS. He's some other unit that you never really told, the Special Weapons Division, and he's working for this group, and you know they're off there to hunt werewolves. They just use our heroes as bait, cannon fodder.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, but that whole film was designed, and I pitched it to everybody. I said, this isn't a werewolf movie with soldiers. This is a soldier movie with werewolves. I wanted to make as authentic a depiction of squaddies as I'd seen in a movie. You see so many movies made about US soldiers. There was hardly any made about British soldiers. And my granddad was in the army. My dad was in the army. I probably would have ended up in the army myself had I not gone the filmmaking route. But I just felt that a lot of films depicted soldiers, you know, not very authentically, and I wanted to get across that humour, that camaraderie and the professionalism about them, that kind of all rolls into one, as you well know, and put them in a movie. It just happened to be about werewolves. But that just made it all the more kind of outrageous.
Had any of the cast served in the military?
No, they hadn't. We did a little bit of training or whatever with them as best we could beforehand, but none of them had actually served in the military. Mm-hmm.
Did you have?
There's not many actors have now. You know, it's not like the old days with like David Niven and all that lot who served in World War II and then went and had careers afterwards. But this generation of actors have rarely been in the military.
And Kevin McKidd must have been a great guy to get for the role.
He was. I mean, it was kind of hot off the back of Trainspotting, really. But yeah, Kev was well up for it. Fancy after doing something very, very different for Trainspotting. And it's also quite a thing that with British actors, unlike American actors, who've all done cop shows and God knows what, so they've all like handled firearms and things. A lot of British actors haven't like had the experience of handling firearms, so that's quite a thrill for them, quite a buzz for them. But they all got really into it, and we had some good training for them. We had this Foreign Legion guy out in Luxembourg who put them through their paces before we shot the film. And Kev McKidd, actually, during this training, he cracked a rib, but he was scared that we might replace him on the film, so he didn't tell us about it until like a week into filming. He was in agony, but he kind of just pushed on through and then told us about it. We were like, well, get yourself sorted, mate. We're not gonna get rid of you, but get yourself sorted.
He had a much better outcome than he did as Tommy, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
He lived through this one.
He was the only one who did, but thankfully.
Did you have military visors? How does that work?
We over in Luxembourg, there was this guy who was ex-French Foreign Legion, and he came and did some training for a few days. Like pretty much all of the crew had served in the military as well, because there's still like national service over, I don't know if there still is, but there was then, but in Luxembourg. So they'd all served in the military. So they all like were there to, advise us if we were doing anything wildly wrong. But also I had a pretty good idea myself about a lot of stuff. So, just everybody just pitched in just to try and get it right.
Yes, it's interesting because back in the day, or certainly back then, the SA-80 was obviously a new weapon to the British Army. I think, it'd been in about 12 years by the time I think the film was
Yeah, and generally disliked by everybody.
Yeah, so the bit where they swapped it for the MP5s or the armor lights or whatever was, yes, every
made a lot of sense. But also, I think at that time, I don't think I'd seen the SA-80 depicted in a movie. I can't think of any. I mean, I've seen a few since, but at the time, it was like, oh, this is kind of like a fresh weapon to see in a movie. But as I say, all the people I talked to was like, God, they hated it. Like, everybody hated it. Did you hate it?
While we're on the subject, I think it's like this. I think for some reason, the British went for a British-made or a Enfield. I don't know if that's what part of Britain that is. But
yeah,
I think they went for like a homemade weapon to, I don't know if that's a financial thing, that the money goes back into the country or whatever.
Sure. And
obviously, that the American Armalite or the M16 would have been the obvious choice because it proved itself in Vietnam. Obviously, you hardly have to clean the thing and it floats and it's lightweight and it uses the 5.56 ammo.
Yeah.
But then, having said that, the first time we held an SA-80 in Royal Marines training, our PW, so our instructor said, don't listen to these old sweats that saying this is a load of shit. It's actually a really good weapon. It's just got teething problems.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of an academic argument because the SLR, which is an incredible weapon, so accurate over distance, but obviously fires the heavier ammunition. And it's not it's not good in close quarter combat or around rocks and stuff because it's so long.
So long, yeah,
but,
yeah.
But you can't take anything away from that either. They're just different. But in Afghanistan, what they found was when you've got an enemy that's hyped up on adrenaline or possibly substances, they'll just keep coming. And the 5.56 didn't have enough stopping power. So they went back to this I shouldn't say a really nice looking weapon when you think what they're used for, but this short, somebody can put in the comments, you know, the weapon I'm thinking of. It was a shorter weapon than the SLR and it fired 7.62. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. They started to issue it to the Special Forces Support Group and obviously the Special Forces themselves. I don't think everybody got it.
Yeah, because the SLR was around for ages.
Yes, yes. Like I say,
I think there seemed to be a perception that the SA-80 was somehow sort of style over content, of like it was more of a design experiment than a functioning weapon. But I guess, you know, it's been stuck with it, so I guess it must have been proved, you know.
Yeah, I don't know they don't even call it the SA-80 anymore. It's Mark so many, you know, Mark 1, 2, 3, 4 is probably about Mark 7 now. And I think they've ironed out a lot of the problems.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. I think one of the issues, I don't know how it is now, but you can only fire it right-handed because the cocking lever is on the right side. So if you were to have it on the other side, it's going to come back and take half your face off every time you fire a round.
Right, yeah, of course.
But could you imagine if you're a left-handed person and that's how you naturally align and suddenly you've got to, it's a bit like trying to throw a rock with your left hand if you're right-handed. It just doesn't feel right.
No, of course, yeah. I mean, we found that on the lair, actually, like one of our axes was left-handed, but we weren't using SA-80s, but even then, it's like just trying to gauge everything. Most weapons are kind of fundamentally designed for right hand. So, yeah, it's interesting.
So what's the, for people that maybe wouldn't know, what's the reason that a film is shot on location rather than, in this case, actually in Scotland?
Money, pretty much. At the end of the day, it's like, it's how much, you know, it costs to get a crew or whatever to a specific location. At the time, with Dog Soldiers at the time, it was quite expensive to shoot in Scotland and it was very cheap to shoot in Luxembourg. And we actually got money from the Luxembourg Film Fund as an incentive to invite us to go there to shoot. Whereas like Scotland was not offering anything up to say, hey, you know, what can we do to make it easy for you guys? It was like, nah, just, you know, this is it. It's full price here. Whereas half price in Luxembourg. So that is pretty much the only reason not to go to the actual location, which, you know, the same with the Lair. It's like, well, obviously there's reasons not to go to Afghanistan, but we couldn't go to a desert country because none of them were like easy or accessible or cost appropriate for the film. So Budapest offered us very good financial incentive to go there. And we ended up filming in a whole bunch of like quarries and places like that to try and make it look like Afghanistan. And the end result is it kind of does. So, you know, we got what we wanted out of it. It would have been nice to go to Morocco or Jordan or somewhere like that to film it, but it was just too expensive.
Yes. Do you know my buddy Marty Stalker by any chance?
I don't know.
Oh, Marty's quite a successful producer, and he, funny enough, he's just been in Afghanistan filming a documentary. They had to go in there completely under the radar, obviously being Westerners, and they just went in just to film the fall of, you know, the fall of everything that's gone on.
Yeah, yeah.
But prior to that, he made a short, I think it was a short, and it was centered on one soldier's PTSD. And again, I think they filmed that in a quarry or somewhere. You'd never know.
Yeah, I think we managed. Yeah, I don't know. That's the movies. It's the magic of movies. That whatever's in the frame, what the audience sees, that's what they take with them, and they don't get to see what's outside the frame. And quite often, what's outside the frame is completely different to what's inside. So, like, you're filming within a quarry, but around you is green fields or something like that. It's like, oh. But also the magic of, you know, visual effects and stuff these days, what they can do, you know, could pretty much do anything. So, yeah, anything's possible.
Yes. Is it, I'm guessing maybe not so much if all your actors are from the same country, but I'm guessing there'd be probably quite some many visa issues moving a crew abroad.
There is. I mean, what you tend to do is like you only bring in a select bunch of people, like the, you know, myself and the producers and maybe some of the cast. Most of the crew you tend to source locally. But with actors and things like that, yeah, depending on where they're coming from, visas can be a bit of an issue. I tell you what's proved difficult now is Brexit. It used to be very, very simple for us to go over to Europe and make a movie. Now we have to get like all these visas, and I had to acquire, because I was there for 3 months, I had to get temporary citizenship in Hungary, like a residency in there. So it's these annoying kind of paperwork and processes that you now have to go through because of Brexit. But other countries, I guess it's probably the same as it ever was. Anything non-European.
Do you still keep in touch with the cast of Dog Soldiers?
I do. Not all of them. Some of them I've lost touch with over the years, but I'm still in touch with Kevin. He's out in LA shooting Grey's Anatomy like full time. So quite a funny the way he's ended up in a hospital drama in LA, making his fortune out there. But you know, we're in tentative talks at the moment for a potential Dog Soldiers sequel. So that'll be nice if we get to do that together. I've worked with Sean a few times since. He was on The Reckoning, and I'm always up for working with Sean. And some of the other guys, I think Les, who played Terry, he's in Australia now. Darren Morfitt, who played Spoon, he's still in London doing the odd bit here and there. I always try to keep in touch with everyone that I work with along the way. If it's been a good experience and good relationships and friendships have formed, then absolutely, which for the most part is exactly what's happened throughout all my movies. So, yeah.
And Liam Cunningham, he's been in a couple of your productions, hasn't he?
Liam is an absolute legend. I've worked on him but worked with him on Centurion and Game of Thrones a few times. So yeah, always a pleasure to work with Lynn.
Who's the chap that his name slips my mind? But great actor, played Sick Boy in Trainspotting.
Johnny Lee Miller.
Yes, of course. Sorry, Johnny, if you ever get to watch this. Yes. despite my bad memory, he is one of my sort of favourite. I certainly loved him in Trainspotting, but he's in LA as well, isn't he? He does some.
He's been doing a show out in LA or New York. I think it might be in New York. What's it called? It's like a modern day Sherlock Holmes.
Okay. Yes. There's certainly a, if you can make it over there, it seems a place that people will stay.
For TV shows and things like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It can be, it's kind of like the Golden Handcuffs as well though. Cause it's great. You get to do nothing but that show for God knows how many, like 10 years or something like that, and make lots of money, but it doesn't allow you to do anything else. And I think that's been a little bit of Kev's frustration of, this series has made him a lot of money and it's great success. He's directing it now. He's been on it for 10 years. But because every time I've approached him to do something else, he hasn't been available because of the commitment to the TV series. And I think maybe that's a little bit frustrating.
Mm. How was the writing process? How did the manuscript for Dog Soldiers come about? Because you wrote it yourself, right?
Yeah, I mean, writing is pain. It's a slow, torturous process for sure. It took 6 years to get Dog Soldiers made. From writing the first draft of that script in 1996 to eventually filming it in 2001. So 1995 to 2001. It was a long, drawn-out process. I think I rewrote it about 18 times before we shot it. But writing like the first version of the first draft of a script is, it depends. Sometimes it can be a joy. Writing Centurion was a real pleasure. I kind of wrote it in about 3 weeks, which never happens. Like I just couldn't wait to just write this thing. Dog Soldiers, I think the first draft was pretty fast, but it was just refining it. When you have the story very, very clear in your head, it comes a lot easier, and the characters as well. And I find those kind of characters like Centurion and like Dog Soldiers quite easy to write for. I like kind of sort of colloquial British characters that are just down to earth, and it's the language I kind of know better because, spent my life in the UK and sitting in pubs listening to people, things like that. It comes more naturally than writing for, say, American characters or people I know less well.
Yes. Just put a lot of F words in for British characters.
It's kind of it, like just creative swearing. It's like coming up with new ways to offend people.
Oh, you don't have to do that. I think people offend themselves these days, don't they?
Very easily, very easily. But like the English language is great for coming up with new swears like that.
What's your thoughts then on this? Must be a kind of, from an artistic perspective, a bit of a killer that when say TV gets a hit series,
yeah,
and they just spin it out for another seven, another seven series. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, having worked in both the TV and film space, so like from the TV space, it's like, yeah, that's exactly what you want to happen. You want your TV show to last for many, many seasons. And, and it's a great, creatively and narratively, it's a great opportunity to tell a story in far, far greater depth, to go into detail that you can't do in a feature film when you've got 7 hours or 10 hours to tell a story as opposed to, two. So as you're creatively speaking, that's great. The frustrating side of it as a film director is that so many actors are now migrating to television because there's good money, good work, great roles. It's like actors want to do lots of TV drama now and things like that. And it's hard to find them available to do your movie. I'm finding that quite a lot, actually. A lot of the cast that you want to get are all tied up for TV series, and they're in, you know, contracts that mean that they're doing it for 5 years minimum, and they can't get out of it, stuff like that. So that's a little bit frustrating. But if you're in the TV world, it's like, that's great. That's exactly what you want. But I would say with television, it's like, especially these new, you know, the new streamers, the Amazons, the Netflix or whatever, the beast needs feeding. That they need new content all the time. If they want to keep people watching, they have to be making TV shows or else they're going to shut down. Mm. So, they can't just survive on repeats and reruns. Whereas movies, on the other hand, do not need to be made. It's nice to make them, and the world would be a sad place without them, but there's no essential, you know, they're not essential to a company's functioning, you know. So we make them for love more than anything, more than necessity. And I think that makes it a little bit different.
Mm. Yeah, the reason I mention it is, just off the top of my head, something like Holby City, obviously you'd want to run for 20 years because it's each episode is a mini drama in itself. But I really loved Vikings when it came out, and also Breaking Bad, I think, is another example. And the cinematography in the early episodes or series was just incredible, as well as the plot. And then you find by the time it's got to the seventh series, it just felt like that they're just spinning out what plot twists can we come up with now,
Well, some shows don't know when to end, and some shows do. And you know, I think the best ones are like, okay, they know that they're going to go, you know, like four seasons, five seasons, or whatever it is, and then we'll tell their story, and it'll have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Something like Holby City doesn't have an end. It's like a soap. It's just designed to go on and on and on and on and on. But like Breaking Bad or such, like, you know, it was designed to come full circle and have a beginning and an end. You can differentiate between the two. But I think what also is interesting is that TV has now caught up with films in terms of production value and the way they look and the way they sound. And, you know, the quality is there. It used to be very, very different. You know, TV was not as good a quality as movies. Now they are. Everything's in HD. We all have our widescreen TVs and our surround sound or whatever it is. You know, we expect our TV to look as good as the movies now, and anything less won't do. And I find that kind of very interesting.
Yes, I hope it doesn't kill cinema, because
I think, yeah, me too, absolutely. And I think it's always the television has always threatened to do that. But the experience, I think, as long as they don't, like, I worry about these day and date releases where they release it in the cinema and on digital at the same time, because I think fundamentally a lot of people are quite lazy and will think, you know, I'll just stay at home and watch it rather than go out to the cinema. But what they're missing is that experience of seeing the film not only on a bigger screen with better sound and such like, but with an audience, and it's a shared experience. And that's the beauty of it. It's like going to a concert or staying home and listening to a record, or, you know, going to the theater. Like, you have that experience with the audience, and when it's good, it's amazing. It's like you feel the energy toward a film or something like that, reactions to the film, and that's what makes cinema such a great medium now. And that's what we all strive for as filmmakers. We want to give the audience that experience, especially if it's like a horror film or a comedy or something like that, where the audience is really getting into it and you can hear them screaming and gasping and laughing and whatever it is that they're doing. I think I very much design my films to be like audience reaction films. Dog Soldiers is very much an audience reaction film. So was The Descent, and that's what I'm doing now. It's like I want to get those audible gasps and screams and laughs and whatever from whoever goes to see the movie, because that, yeah, it means they're enjoying it more.
I must be a bit antisocial, because when I go to the cinema, I wouldn't be happier than if I was on my own.
I think I do agree that there is a time and a place for like going to see a cinema. Going to the cinema and watching a movie on your own, and you really concentrate on the movie, and it's a great experience. And I've done that many times. But it's also great with a crowd. As long as that crowd are like into the movie, they're not on their bloody telephones or they're chatting amongst themselves, then it becomes a nightmare. And it's easy for that to happen. But yeah.
I have my sort of set routine at the cinema, and I love cinema. I've always loved cinema. My gran used to take us when we were really young, weekly, to see a different, some of them sort of matinees that used to come out. You never heard of them, but they were just such great films.
Yeah.
But when I go now and you got the online booking, I always book the back row because I don't want people behind me. It's just like a comfort thing. I don't want to hear talking behind me or crisps and popcorn and stuff. And I always, because now age is on my side, or age is against me, I book the two seats down the aisle. So there's no one, not just there's no one in front of me, but if I need to get up and use the toilet, I can just run down the aisle and then run back up again.
I think everybody has their movie strategy, yeah. Where's the best place to sit?
And if I get there and someone else is sat in my seat, I have no hesitation saying, I'm sorry. I'm normally quite reserved and quite polite, believe it or not. But in this case, I'll say, sorry, you're in my seat. No.
I think that's fair enough. I think this is the thing of booking in advance and getting your tickets and your seat numbers, whatever you want. You want to get that seat. You want to get the best seat.
Yeah, I think... Ricky Gervais is in a good position, isn't he? Because his TV dramas or docu-comedies or whatever they're called, he just does the two series, doesn't he? Because he doesn't want it to become something that he doesn't want it... You know what I'm trying to say, Neil, don't you?
Well, he's doing the third season of, what's it called, Afterlife?
Okay.
He's doing a third season of that because it's been such a huge success for him. But I mean, he goes in, he does something really good and then just ends it and leaves and does something else and doesn't drag it on forever. You know, The Office was the right length and then he got out. And the mistake was going back and doing a David Brent movie or whatever, but you know, everybody makes mistakes.
Oh, I really quite like that. Was it On the Road? Life on the Road or something?
I think so, yeah. But it just, I don't know. It just wasn't the same. It was like, you know, you did that, let it go.
Yeah, yeah, okay. There's always that temptation, isn't there, to try and just have one, just get a little bit more out of it.
Yeah, I suppose so. Mm. I suppose so.
What have been your can we talk favourite films now?
Of course. So the results, no matter what else changes around it, there is always a number one movie that is my favourite movie of all time and will always be my favourite movie of all time. It's the movie that inspired me to make movies. And so that's Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yes. But around that, there'll be a whole bunch of other movies like... I grew up with Steven Spielberg in the 80s. So like, you know, Close Encounters, Jaws, Raiders, E.T., all those movies like just, you know, have ingrained themselves in my soul, I think. But around that, I love movies like The Wild Bunch. I love A Bridge Too Far. I love Lawrence of Arabia. I love Heat. All these kind of things as well.
Seven Samurai?
Seven Samurai, a classic. Also The Magnificent Seven, you know. I love Kurosawa movies. He's fantastic. I love so many movies. It's like I'm definitely an action person. More than anything, I love great action cinema. So like The Shootout in Heat is incredible. Things like that.
There's one scene in Seven Samurai. It's the bit at the beginning where they're recruiting the warriors to go up to the village and protect the village, and he stands behind the door in the hut, and he says, right, when each one comes in, try and smack them over the head with his stick, and we'll see their their samurai skills. And the first six come in, and they're like, "Wah!" And they're all these ultimate ninjas. And then the last guy comes in, and he goes, "Poof!" He goes, Ow! Why did you do that?
That's great.
What about First Blood?
Huge fan of First Blood.
Good. I knew you'd have my back.
I love First Blood. I think it's kind of sad what's happened to the Rambo character, because First Blood is an incredible movie. The rest of them were like popcorn fun, and or they've gone downhill like steadily as they've gone. But the first one is just a really, really well made and a brilliant film. Brilliant film. Love it. Mm-hmm. When I went to Canada, I visited as many of the locations as I possibly could. I do that if I'm in the area where something I love has been filmed. Like, I have to go and find the locations and things like that, because it's just to be a piece of that movie, you know.
There's a great video on YouTube about somebody that they went and they found all the locations in First Blood, yeah, all the main where, and it's funny when you see them,
all that stuff. Yeah, I know, it's fascinating. I think I've watched that one. Mm-hmm. To see the cliffs and all that stuff, and then because I visited the town where they shot it, and it was kind of just, this wasn't that long after the film was made. And I was really disappointed to find the police station didn't exist, that they built it for the film and then it's long gone now. But all the rest of the buildings are kind of there. So, yeah, very, very cool movie. You know, Stallone was awesome in that movie as well.
Oh, it was so gritty. It was just... And also it was a real change, wasn't it? Because normally, I think when the producers first got the script, a lot of them went, hang on, what... guys like mentally deranged, we don't do that, we do like hero movies, and I think it
I'm glad that, you know, because I've read the book as well, and the book is pretty dark, and I'm glad they didn't kill him in the end, but just for that film. But yeah, I like all that kind of gritty adventure escapism stuff. It's just, you know, and films like that, Deliverance, The Edge, all those kind of things inspired my next movie, which was The Descent, which is, you know, people out in the middle of nowhere and shit goes wrong. But yeah, First Blood, huge inspiration. Have you seen a movie called The Professionals?
You might have to talk my...
I'm not talking about Lewis Collins and CI5. Made in the late 60s, a film with Lee Marvin and Burt Lancaster called The Professionals, about a bunch of mercenaries who go into Mexico to kidnap Claudia Cardinale. And it's just one of the great kind of mercenary movies. It's just awesome. It's a really good, it's great dialogue and great action and stuff like that. I think you might like it.
Yeah, I've probably seen it, just my memory isn't what it used to be. That First Blood's funny because my poor son, he's only six, but I forced all the 80s and 90s movies onto him.
Got to be done.
Well, it was my birthday yesterday, so we just watched Rocky III. We've got the whole series, and
yeah,
I don't know if that's appropriate for 6-year-old, but he does go to Taekwondo, so he does kind of, you know, get the whole fight thing. I'm banned from showing him First Blood at this moment in time, which, okay, yeah, you got to take a hit sometimes.
I think so. But I think, you know, once he gets to like 9, 10, that's the time to show it to him.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the age that, like, a lot of my favorite films I saw around between like 9 and 11. Like, boom, just that period of time. And I think First Blood was around then as well. Things like that. Raiders was definitely around then. That's the time.
I remember showing him E.T. and I think the first time around, you think he was too young. I just didn't get it. But we have watched it subsequently.
Mm-hmm.
And now when we watched it the other day, we've had one of the stunt riders on the show.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, Robert Cardoza. He's a very wonderful gentleman. And he was... he rocked up on the set with Steven Spielberg, and his job was just to take these bikes, the Kuaras or Kuaharas.
Yeah, yeah.
This phenomenal BMX bike that the world had yet to really see, or certainly in England we had. And when he got on set, Steven Spielberg saying, yeah, we've got this great stunt guy. And the guy promptly like fell off his bike. and Robert said to him, that's he's a stuntman, but he's not a BMXer. I'm a BMXer. Do you want me to show you? And so he promptly jumped over Steven Spielberg's Porsche. He said, yeah, I can get all the guys to come on board and do all the stunt work. So Bob Harrow, that was a very famous name from the BMX era. He's in it. And we had Robert on the show the other day, and it's a wee bit of a shame to me that stuff like that, to me, it's just legend. It's just, you know, when am I ever going to get to chat to someone who was in E.T., for crying out loud, and they did the BMX scene, which is just any 80s kid favorite scene.
It's very, very cool. Very cool. Mm. Yeah. And these are things that are like iconic. Like, you know, like he was one of the guys, kids on the BMX. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
But I think I'm kind of on my own in my like sometimes, because our audience doesn't seem to pick up on it. I don't know if that's an age thing or what it is. Have you ever seen It's All Gone, Pete Tong?
I have not, no.
Is it Paul Kaye? He's quite a British actor, very funny.
Okay.
He used to be Dennis Penis.
Yes.
Saturday night, that funny Saturday night show. Was it? Let me just check. I've got his.
Yeah. Dennis Penis.
Paul Kaye. He plays this DJ in Ibiza that loses his hearing, and then goes through the mill with the cocaine and stuff, and then it's just probably because a lot of it mirrors my life. It's just one of those films. Something's got so many one-liners in
I know of it. I just haven't checked it out, but I'll check it out for sure.
He's there and he's deaf, and he says, "It was almost great to hear that." And the funny thing was, Paul Kaye, if his interviews are to be believed, he never was into like the rave scene or anything. He just said he was a hardcore drinker back in the day, and yet he plays this, you know, Ibiza DJ just perfectly, or certainly the kind of caricature of what we'd think. Yes.
Oh, cool. No, definitely. I like a good recommendation, so I'll check it out.
Yeah, no, it's good, but it's also that thing, isn't it, that what is art to someone and what's enjoyable to one person can just go over someone else's head.
Well, that's both the beauty and the pain of it. That's what makes it great, but it also makes it painful sometimes. But
because you were involved in Hellboy.
That's the pain side. Yeah, I was.
Yeah, were you a producer in that?
No, I directed it.
Sorry, director.
For my sins. Yes. That was just a mistake all around, really. It was just it was a terrible script and a terrible idea. And I was lured in for all the wrong reasons of a bit of cash, but mainly because I hadn't made a feature film in like 9 years and was so hungry to make another feature film. That when this one presented itself, I kind of jumped at the chance without sort of stopping to notice just how bad the whole thing was. And I don't know, kind of blustered my way through it. But yeah, you can't polish a turd, as they say.
Was it that bad? I've got this thing that I really like real life. So I like stuff that could actually be real, give or take, you know, a plot twist or whatever.
Yeah. Well, it's not remotely like that. It's completely fantastical. There's nothing
based on a Marvel comic, was it?
It's not Marvel. But it is based on a series of graphic novels. Yeah.
Yeah, I could never get into that stuff.
Me neither. I jumped into Hellboy in prep for the movie, but as a kid, I was never into comics or anything like that. It's like not my scene. It was all movies for me, just movies.
Yeah, I was exactly the same. I used to like reading adventure books and, you know, stuff that could actually be real. So I don't really, my girlfriend loves all that stuff. She grew up with Marvel and, you know, the Avengers and all this sort of stuff. And I just didn't really
encounter that. I think a lot of people, you know, so much of what I like was inspired by my dad and stuff like that. So survival stuff, adventure stuff, outdoors stuff, military stuff, things like that was what I kind of grew up on. So First Blood and things like that, perfect.
The Revenant, is it?
Yeah.
That was Leonardo DiCaprio, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Have you got this thing? My girlfriend hates watching a film with me because I am one of those people that goes, well, that wouldn't happen. And because I'm an author, I can see where they've stitched stuff together.
I tend not to. I'll think about these things, but I'll tend to keep it to myself. Watching a movie or whatever, but I try not to be that guy who's like, oh, that's just, yeah, no, that wouldn't happen. That would, yeah, but I'm thinking it.
I try not to be it, but apparently I am. Oh, I think actually, to be honest, it's not so much with films and stuff. It's more. I've got to be careful. I can't drop any names in here, but there's certain survival programs,
right,
that are so ridiculously fabricated. And I don't. You said you like survival yourself. I've always read, you know, like the SAS survival manual. I think Lofty Wiseman, we're trying to get Lofty on the show for a while. I've been chatting to him and loved all that sort of stuff. And I've got this thing that I don't like being lied to. I don't mind if someone says, look, you know, in a real situation, you're probably never going to catch a rabbit unless you're really, really lucky and your skills, you know, you've lived in the nature your whole life. So for the purposes of exercise, we've bought these ones from a pet shop, maybe a pet shop. I don't mind. I like that sort of approach, but I don't like this constant lying to the kids, this giving them this false idea of what it is to be a man or what it is to survive.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair enough, because some of them make it look like survival is kind of a walk in the park, like oh yeah, just go out, find this, eat this, find that, eat that, like, yeah, it's not that easy.
no. So let's talk about the lair then. How did this come about?
I'd just done a film called The Reckoning. I shot it in 2019, and it deals with the plague. And of course, it came out in 2020. So it's like we had no idea what was going to happen in 2020, but there was a film, we made a film about a plague. And then off the back of that, I wanted to make more of a, so that was a horror film, but it's kind of very gothic and slightly drama and more sort of esoteric. And then I came off the back of that wanting to make much more of a kind of old school blood and guts action horror film, like Dog Soldiers, like The Descent, like I started out making, and had this idea of there's something going on in Afghanistan or whatever. Because of the Russians and things like that. So I had all these ideas brewing. And it seemed like at the time, because I wrote it, you know, during COVID and lockdown and stuff like that, was like, is it a film that I could make under those circumstances? Because I knew that certain films were getting made. But it was helpful if it was like a small group of people, a few locations, and maybe somewhere like hot and sunny to go out and work in. So I was like, that's where the desert sort of setting came from. So wrote The Lair and got it on soldiers and explosions and guns and monsters and things like that. Just a lot of fun. Just wanted to make a fun movie. And so I wrote that 2020 and managed to, you know, get the money together to shoot it this year. It all came together very, very quickly.
And this is Charlotte Kirk. I'm just looking at the other screen now.
So, yeah, so Charlotte is my co-creator and partner in crime, and she's also the lead in the movie because she was the lead in The Reckoning as well. She's my muse.
Yeah, it's do you guys got some sort of synergy going on then?
Oh, definitely. Well, we're engaged for a start, so we've definitely got some synergy going on.
Well, bloody hope so, yeah.
But creatively, like she comes much more from a dramatic kind of acting background, and I come from sort of, you know, monster movies and directing and such like, and we kind of meet in the middle somewhere. Like, so a lot of the ideas that she throws into these things is very left field for me, but they make a lot of sense, so, you know, and it's very character based sort of stuff. So it kind of we meet in the middle and bounce ideas backwards and forwards, and it works really, really well.
Yes, because it's hard, isn't it, to find somebody that has your vision?
Yes, it's very difficult. But I think early on we could tell we were into the same kind of things and movies and things like that. So she's a huge fan of John Carpenter's The Thing and Aliens and The Shining and stuff like that. And it's like, okay, these are all some of my favorite movies as well. And these are the kind of things that we're aspiring to. So, you know, The Lair, we wanted to sort of make something akin to Aliens that would like leave people as shell shocked as that did when I first saw it.
When will it be released?
We'll finish it around about January, February, and then hopefully we'll be released later that year.
Is it what are the biggest headaches then when you're on set or you're trying to get something like this to, I mean, obviously it's different whether you're producing or directing or writing.
Yeah.
But can you give us a few ideas for those of us that have never?
The biggest problem is always never having enough time. We had 30 days to shoot it, which sounds like a lot, but when you try to do an action film, and that's a lot, you know, when, like a Marvel movie or something like that, they'll have like 200 days to shoot something like that. So, you know, or more, you know, even something like Raiders of the Lost Ark had 75 days to shoot it. So we had 30 days, which to try and do something like that is not easy when you're dealing with a lot of action, you're dealing with dangerous stuff such as stunts, explosives, firearms. You know, we were lucky enough to get to use blank firing weapons, which it's not that common for a low budget movie. Like a lot of them nowadays, it's like they use what are they called? They're replica guns, but they like fire little ball bearings, but they don't fire them in the film. They just pull the trigger and click, click, click. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, they add in the sound effect and the muzzle flash. But you can tell because the actors aren't. There's no kickback to it. There's no recoil, and the muzzle flash doesn't give off any interactive lighting around them. Whereas using blank firing weapons, we got, you know, the actors felt it allowed them to be more authentic in like handling the weapons because they're dangerous, whereas the plastic ones are not. And just getting them to respect the weapons and, you know, respect how to handle them, such like, I think this is really, really important. And then the actual interaction with the weapon when it's firing all just makes it look more gritty and realistic. And that's key to the kind of things that I want to do. But yeah, I mean, we had a fairly small cast, like 10 people total, and some tricky locations, some very unpleasant locations. but it's just time. You're just waiting to do as much as possible in the shortest amount of time. And that's always tricky. Mm. And you can't like shout and scream at people. I'm not interested in doing that. And nobody wants to work for somebody who's going to shout and scream at them. So it's just trying to, you know, keep people excited and enthused and motivated and keep them going.
Yes. I can tell you another of my pet hates now then. It's not a pet hate. It just amazes me that Hollywood will spend X amount of $1 million on a film, and no one has told the actor you don't shut your eyes when you fire a weapon. Is that something you've come across?
Well, definitely. I think it's really difficult for people who like they've only had a couple of days practice or whatever that to get used to it. I know Charlotte blinked a few times when she was firing. No, she didn't shut her eyes, but she, you know, blinked. But I know Mel Gibson's kind of famous for it. He can't not blink when he fires a weapon. And I don't think a lot of actors do, but yeah, that's kind of interesting. I think some were fine, some blinked, but like I said, nobody was like holding their eyes shut when they were firing. There's nothing like that going on. You know, we tried to keep it as realistic as we could.
Did you have to get actors to play local Afghans?
We did. We actually found a couple of local guys of Afghan origin to play the Afghans. Some of the others are like stuntmen in heavy disguise, but for anybody who features, you know, we got some authentic actors for the roles.
Mm. And Neil, it's been absolutely wonderful chatting. Is there anything you'd like to, if you'd like to promote or add?
Not at the moment. I mean, and, you know, The Lair isn't coming out until next year. So, I mean, people just look out for that. That'd be great. And yeah.
And one last thing we should talk about. Did you do some episodes of Westworld?
I did an episode of Westworld, yes.
How was that?
It was the opportunity to do a Western, for one. I never had a chance to do a Western before. I got to do some shootouts and things like that, which was great fun. We got to work with Ed Harris, which was great, but mainly I got to work with Anthony Hopkins. I got to direct Hopkins, which is like, you know, a legend. So, yeah, it was a blast.
I'm guessing you saw the original Westworld film.
I love the original movie. And because my episode was in season one of the TV show, but I'm afraid I have not watched the other two seasons yet. Just haven't got around to it.
Yeah, this goes back to what I was saying earlier. I think we watched the first season because I was obviously a big fan of the original film with Yul Brynner. And I don't know that it did get to a point where it just got really technical.
Yeah.
And involved.
Well, it was quite technical anyway, but I couldn't see, as a concept, I couldn't really see how it could sustain itself as a story as to where it was going to go into the wider world. You know, that the Westworld concept would basically burn out in the first season because they'd have to expand it, and then you kind of forget about the fact that it was Westworld, which was the whole point in the first place. So I don't know. I need to check out the other two seasons and see what's like.
Hey, I'm available if you... I can always squeeze in a shooting in my calendar, mate.
If we need any military advisors or anything like that, that'd be good.
Well, I've just landed my first film role with the wonderful Martin Webster, who's just released Penitent.
Great.
Which is congratulations. It's a lovely little film shot on incredibly low budget. But it's been winning awards, so good on Martin. But yeah, no, he's just offered me I'm going to guess it's probably more of a cameo in his latest production.
Are you itching to get in front of the camera? Is that it?
No, Neil, I'm one of these people that if I had a little role in a film, I'd be so happy for the rest of my life. I just
fancy giving it a try and seeing. Try a bit of everything.
I don't really even care what it is. I'm not out to, you know, I don't want to be the next Brad Pitt or anything, although a lot of people will obviously make that mistake. No, it's just that when I was a little boy, I just dreamed of things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like I dreamed of diving off the cliff at Acapulco when I saw the Elvis movie. And then as an adult, I'm in Acapulco. What am I going to do? I'm swimming across that lagoon, climbing up the cliff, and I'm diving off. Not from the top, folks. It's 42 meters high, but
that's pretty high.
But it's silly little things like that. I mean, I've caught piranhas in the Amazon because
fantastic.
The books that I read when I was a teenager were, you know, I read about people catching piranhas in the Amazon, and there's this fish and it can eat a horse or something. And I mean, obviously writing a book is quite a nice thing to achieve. And now I tick my little thing every day because I get to speak to wonderful, talented people like yourself, Neil. So just to have a little role in a film, I don't care what it is, I'll be very happy about that.
All right. I will keep that in mind for sure.
Yes. I will. I'm sorry, I wasn't putting the pressure on you, but Martin has now offered me something. So
that's great. My only thing is that I'd love to shoot something in the UK again. I haven't shot in the UK for a long time, so I'd like to do that. And there's a whole bunch of people I want to get in, like cameo roles and stuff. So
I'll have to send you a copy of my memoir, Eating Smoke. I've been approached by. Is it William Morris is the biggest agency in Hollywood or one of the I've been approached now by Hollywood about 10 times for the rights to where is it? My first memoir, Eating Smoke.
Oh cool.
One man's descent into crystal meth psychosis in Hong Kong's triad heartland.
Wow.
And nothing ever came of it. But I spoke to the wonderful Lyle Howery the other day, who's also a producer. He's over there in Hollywood. And he said, send it across, Chris. But the way I explained it to Lyle is there was a time when you had classic films. Do you remember Midnight Express?
Yes.
Just, oh, my God. And it seems now that Hollywood just shy away from that. From just creating classics, and they stick with the kind of tried and tested, you know, comic and this sort of stuff. But Eating Smoke would be, it would just be great on the screen. I think it might need a sort of Danny Boyle take on it because of the psychosis aspect. But yes.
No, it sounds like good subject matter. So, like, I can't believe like somebody like an Amazon or something like that isn't trying to, you know, do it.
Yes, I'll ping you a copy. Tell me what.
Yeah, yes, please. Thank you.
No, thank you, Neil. It's just been an absolutely wonderful chat, and I get to ask all the things that are in my head. I wish you all the best with the lair.
Cheers.
And I can't wait to, can't wait to see it.
And, can't wait to show it to people.
Yeah, and feel free to come on the show again and when it comes out and let us know how it's going.
All right, yes, thank you.
So stay on the line so I can thank you properly when I hit the record off. But to our friends at home, massive love to you all. Thank you for continuing to support the channel. I hope you love this chat as much as I did. If you can like and subscribe, that will be legendary. And we'll see you next time.
Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.